Hello, everyone. I'm Trent Luce. Welcome to another edition of Rural Routes, the program where we gather every day at this time, Monday through Friday anyway, and we address and discuss the issues between rural and urban America. The Attorney General of the State of Oklahoma, Scott Pruitt, if we could only find you, if you could get your computer working, Scott, we could have done this yesterday.
Well, you know how that works, right? I mean, NSA probably had something to do with it.
Oh, wait. I never thought about that. You think they put a virus on my computer?
Oh, we're not conspiracy folks, are we? So probably not. But no. These days, you just don't know.
I'm getting about an email a day, sometimes more. Somebody, even Rick Jensen, posted on Facebook this week what a great American the Attorney General from the state of Oklahoma is. So I thought, well, I better get him on here and see if it's real. You're getting a little attention, Scott. Are you aware of that?
Well, I know that we have some cases that are obviously very notable across the country, and justifiably so, because we've got some folks, as you know, that the agency, Fish and Wildlife Service particularly, that are engaging in some activities that somebody needs to check them, and we're doing that.
I don't know how I should set this up, but I'll just tell you. Last week, I am in San Joaquin Valley in California. And everybody knows that the Delta Schmelt and 5 protected fish have been an issue in the Delta, the Sacramento, and the San Joaquin rivers for some period of time. They have dumped about $6 million in habitat restoration into improving the habitat for the Delta Schmelt. And Attorney General Pruitt, guess what they've accomplished? They have built the habitat for the predator fish. Now, 95% of the fish in those rivers are non-native. They're invasive species. They're predator fish, and as the predator fish population grows, the fish that they're protecting decline. And I bring that up now because it looks to me like they want the lesser prairie chicken to be the same exact scenario. What did they do by listing that as a threatened species, and what should we do?
Well, as you know, Trent, I mean, the lesser prairie chicken is being hunted in Kansas, so to list the lesser prairie chicken is a threat species in light of that. This seems to be terribly outlandish and non-commonsensical, but that's what we see out of federal agencies these days. Mm-hmm. And what they did, Trent, here, is something that we've seen with the EPA and other agencies across the federal government. They engaged in something called sue and settle, where an environmental group, in this instance, the Wild Earth Guardians, brings a lawsuit against Fish and Wildlife Service. They did so in 2010, by the way. And then shortly thereafter, the Fish and Wildlife Service kind of raises the white flag, capitulates, and agrees to things in the settlement that are inconsistent with the statute. You know, as you know, it's fifth grade civics. Administrative agencies exist to administer the laws as they're passed by Congress, because Congress is the representative body. That's who you and I send to Washington, D.C. to make laws, and the agencies are responsible to administer those laws, to carry those laws out, not to change them, not to repeal them, not to amend them. But that's exactly what Fish and Wildlife Service did here through litigation. They got sued, they raised the white flag, they agreed to a settlement that changed fundamentally the statute with the endangered species as it applies to lesser prairie chicken. And by the way, about 250 other species. So it is a very important case, Trent, because it is what we've seen agencies doing at the federal level of just regulating through litigation. They bypass Congress. It's the president's message. I've got a pen. I've got a phone. I'm going to instruct my agency heads to go out and do what I tell them to do and bypass the representative process that we know is the checks and balances to keep these agencies from running amok. And it leading to crazy outcomes like the one you described or the one here with West Prairie Chicken.
Mm-hmm. You just said something that I even overlooked. And not that I'm all-knowing, but I try to pay attention to these things. There are 250 other species included in this proposal?
Yes, yes. And to unpack that a little bit further, you know, lawsuit in 2010, consent decree, and a consent decree is just a fancy term for a vehicle. It's what captures the settlement between Fish and Wildlife Service and Wild Earth Guardians. And it's submitted to the court. The court approves it. And then the agency has to act consistent with the consent decree. And what they did here, Trent, there are three categories under the Endangered Species Act statutorily. Congress said there are three categories. Warranted, meaning that they're threatened or endangered. Secondly, not warranted, meaning that they should not be threatened or they're not considered a threatened species. Or thirdly, warranted but precluded. And that third category is a study category. It's the agency recognizing that there are some species out there that may, in fact, be threatened, but we need to study it. We need to analyze it. We need to engage in scientific inquiry to determine whether this is a species that we want to put in that first bucket. Well, what they did in the settlement, Trent, is they eliminated the third category. They just simply said, we're going to eliminate it. It's a statutory, by the way, statutory requirement. They just took it away, and they took all 250-plus species and said, we're going to make a determination about all 250 species within a truncated timeline. So we're going to expedite it. And at the same time they did it, they acknowledged that they didn't have the resources, the time in which to make a fair determination about all those 250 species. So it put an undue obligation on Fish and Wildlife to accelerate the process, which leads to things like lesser prairie chicken being put in protected status as of March 27th. Mm-hmm. So it is truly regulation through litigation. It's an agency bypassing rulemaking. It's an agency bypassing congressional mandate and engaging in a friendly lawsuit, quote unquote, with these environmental groups that have a much different agenda than what the rulemaking process is supposed to represent. And we, in the state of Oklahoma, said we're going to do something about it. So we sued Fish and Wildlife in the Northern District of Oklahoma in federal court, and we told them that that consent decree, that settlement that they entered into in 2011, violates the law and cannot be enforced in the state of Oklahoma. And that's what the lawsuit's about.
Have you had other state support, states that particularly that are affected by this potential threatened species listening?
Yes, other states have joined. Kansas jumped in. North Dakota jumped in. Farm Bureau in Oklahoma jumped in. The Domestic Energy Producers Alliance, DEPA, is also a plaintiff. Obviously, from energy to farming and ranching to agriculture, there are state interests. There are many folks that are very interested and concerned about what Fish and Wildlife Service did, and they were excited to join our lawsuit and hopefully hold these folks accountable.
Hopefully it will provide a check and balance to the system, and your lawsuit counters the lawsuit that forced Fish and Wildlife to make this step. In the bigger picture,
yeah.
Scott, I mean, this is we can get focused on this. We can talk about the Delta Schmelt. We can talk about the lesser prairie chicken or the 250 other species. But the big picture here is that the federal government and particularly the agencies, the EPA, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, the USDA, are all running amok. And where you started, they're not executing the will of Congress. They're out there executing, as the president said in the State of the Union address, by the way, in January, is that we're going to bypass the congressional system. We're going to execute more of the authority that I have as a president with my agencies. This is what needed to be done in terms of a lawsuit today. But in the bigger picture, what's the answer to this overreach of the federal government?
Well, Trent, you've described it really well. I mean, there is an attitude that is coming out of Washington. It's a command and control approach. It's a consolidation of power through agencies that the president is engaged in. And it's an attitude that says, you know what, we know the statute says A, B, or C, but we want to improve upon that statute. We think it's better to do it this way. And they're doing it. And it's quite remarkable. I mean, rule of law, people talk about that today much more than they did 10 years ago, thank goodness. Because, what separated us historically from other countries around the globe is that we had something in our system of government. The law is bigger than any given elected leader. The law constrains even the president. When the president can take a statute like he's done with the Affordable Care Act or like he's done with, these issues around EPA and environmental laws and simply disregard what the statute says, he or she is acting above the law, Trent. And that causes harm. That causes a lack of confidence in our system. If you're a hospital or a doctor or a insurance company or even a business, for the last 18 months to 2 years, you've been planning on how to conform and comply with the Affordable Care Act. You may not like the law, but it's the law of the land, and you're taking steps to make sure that you allocate resources, you hire employees, you do all that you need to do to comply with the law. When the president, in the midst of all that, Trent, this changes the rules, this says, well, the statute says that, but we're not going to do that. How do you plan? How do you deploy resources? How do you truly conform your conduct to that which is expected? You can't. And that's exactly what's happening in the environmental context as well. Here in the state of Oklahoma with Fish and Wildlife Service, this lesser prairie chicken was placed in that third category that I mentioned years ago. And Oklahoma, along with many others, state stakeholders, private landowners, a coalition of energy and others, we spent $26 million in a voluntary conservation plan to avoid the lesser prairie chicken ever making it into the threat category, the first category. And, in fact, Fish and Wildlife Service approved that in March of 2013. So you had the states and business and others taking steps to engage in voluntary, you know, steps to protect the lesser prairie chicken, and Fish and Wildlife Service just kicks it out. Yeah. And says, because of this lawsuit with Wild Earth Guardians, we're going to take away that category, causing the state and all the various folks to lose $26 million. It's hugely important. It is bigger than this case, Trent, and it's something that we've got to get back to courts constraining these agencies to pull them back to their real mission, which is to administer the laws as passed by Congress and not acting in the super legislative way. So right now the best approach is through the courts. Because we know this executive branch, he's not going to do it.
Attorney General Scott Pruitt, my guest, the state of Oklahoma. We'll be back with more. Roll right after this. Welcome back to Rural Route. I'm Trent Luce. How fitting that we did not get this pulled off yesterday like we were supposed to, Attorney General Scott Pruitt. Because tonight, I'm in Oklahoma today. I'm actually speaking in Stillwater tonight. You're going to come over to
the campus?
Coming, yeah.
You're coming to God's country.
I am coming to God's country. It's what all other countries, the barometer is placed upon how things are in Stillwater, Oklahoma.
You know why it's God's country, don't you?
Because you filed a lawsuit against the God and said you make this your country?
Well, that contributes to it. It's God's country because the President of the United States, President Obama, hasn't won a county in the state in two election cycles.
Are you sure about that?
I'm absolutely sure. He's won a couple precincts, but he hasn't won any counties in the state of Oklahoma for two cycles.
Have you looked at the counties in the Great Plains that he did win in the past two cycles?
I have not.
The first cycle I can't speak to, but the last cycle, the only counties from North Dakota border to Texas that he won were Indian reservations. Every other county went to his Mitt Romney.
Wow.
So,
you know, your question that we ended the last segment on, Trent, on, you know, effectively, what do you do with the president who's unfaithful in executing the laws that have been passed by Congress? You know, Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution says that the president has a duty. It's an affirmative duty to faithfully execute the laws, to take care to faithfully execute the laws. And you know, this isn't a matter of opinion. It isn't a matter of subjective, you know, comment on whether the president has not done that. The Congressional Research Service has documented multiple times that the president has simply just changed or repealed the law with the Affordable Care Act alone. So it is a different world that we're in today, where the executive just doesn't, you know, the executive is supposed to enforce the law. It's not supposed to make the law. And he's definitely acting inconsistent with his obligations, you know, under the Constitution.
I want to correct your terminology in two things, and I want you to work on this for the future. Number one, we will not refer to those groups as environmental groups, because the true environmentalists are the men and women who are actually taking care of the land. So we'll call those groups the pseudo-environmental groups.
Okay.
And the other terminology I want you to fix is I prefer you refer to it as the Unaffordable Health Care Act, because
got
a report yesterday across the board, healthcare premiums since the Unaffordable Health Care Act up 41% across the board. Unaffordable Health Care Act. It's not like you have a shortage of things to work on. You're also involved in litigation with my home state of Nebraska, led by our counterparts in Missouri, against the state of California for violation of the Constitution. Seems like it must be in the water, violating the Constitution. Where does that stand as we, and I know this is an ongoing case that we can't talk a lot about, but still, from your perspective, the state of Oklahoma, California is telling us how to house our animals, and this is a precedent that we can't allow happen either.
You know, you're talking about the egg litigation where California in 2010, or maybe it was 2008, I'm sorry, passed.
2008 Proposition 2 passed,
right,
which was the voter initiative. It was 2010 that AB 1437 passed, which said if you're going to sell eggs in California, which to the tune of 22 million eggs a day go into California, you're going to comply with our Proposition 2 standards. So, yes.
That's right. And those two steps by California drew into question the Commerce Clause. The Commerce Clause under the Constitution, Trent, was really set up at its core was to prevent the states at that time from just, you know, basically providing tariffs and other types of penalties with the importation of goods. The founders wanted a free flow of goods and services from across state line, and the Commerce Clause was set up to make sure that one state didn't discriminate against another. That's what we have here. You have California trying to dictate a policy for every state in the country that harvests eggs. And in these states, you know, you mentioned Oklahoma, there are several states, or six, I think, total,
yes,
sue California to say that they've taken a discriminatory step. I mean, they've taken these cages that the hens are in, as you know, Trent, and they basically want them to be the size where they can do yoga, I guess.
No, they don't even know what size they want them, because they say they want them bigger, but it doesn't clearly specify how big yoga chickens are.
That's right. And there's no scientific basis, by the way, that is somehow beneficial to the consumer and those who consume eggs. It's just simply a regulatory policy that clearly is anti-agricultural and anti-farming. And they're trying to dictate that policy across the country. To me, that goes to the heart of the Commerce Clause. And that's why Oklahoma joined in the lawsuit. That's why we sued California. We believe that they are violating the Constitution and trying to dictate farming policy across the country. I mean, Oklahoma ought to do that. Nebraska ought to do that. Missouri ought to do that. Iowa ought to do that. Not California, for the rest of the country. And that's why we're in the litigation.
Yeah, the true sad part of that story is that California can attempt to tell us how to house chickens to sell them eggs, but they can't tell Mexico because that's a violation of NAFTA.
Yeah, that is very interesting.
Yeah, well, that's sad for Californians.
And they're unapologetic in what they're trying to do.
Yeah, well, they brought it upon themselves.
You know, we see this with fuel standards, too. So you do see both the coasts, both East and West Coast, states taking a similar attitude that we see out of Washington, you know, using, you know, the state's influence to try to dictate regulatory and legal policy in the farming context as well as the energy context.
I have one other thing that I want to get to before we get back to lesser prairie chicken, all things threatened. You have stepped outside of your comfort zone, maybe, bringing to the awareness of the Oklahoma citizen that HSUS is not the real entity that they claim to be. You said you've actually, as a result of the tornadoes that hit, what, Elk City, I believe, was the biggest one. They were in there pretending to help, taking a lot of money out of the state of Oklahoma. And how many dollars have you found that they have given to local shelters to help with those animals, the Humane Society of the United States I speak of?
Well, you're asking, you know, and you're asking about obviously the tornadoes that hit Oklahoma last year. And as you know, there were a spate of tornadoes, the hardest of which hit Moore. And it was kind of amazing last year, Trent, as I was heading I-35 south, we had about 30 investigators on the ground within hours after the tornadoes hit because of all the, you know, concern over consumer fraud and charitable fraud and the rest. And I was going down I-35 to the affected site, looked to the west of I-35, heading down to Moore, and saw a row of cars with signs, placards, where they had taken magic markers and written, "Donate here." And so we had people traveling into the state within hours after the tornadoes hit, seeking to take advantage of the generosity of Oklahomans to help those in a time of need. You know, that is absolutely what this office, we actually have a charitable oversight function where we make sure that 501c3s that raise money in the state of Oklahoma actually spend money for the purposes that they raise. And you brought up we are engaged in a very important inquiry with the Humane Society at the national level to determine whether they came into the state after the Moore tornado, ran the ads that you see all over the country where people see the displaced animals, and they obviously are very concerned about those animals, and they want to assist those local shelters. And so they give money not knowing that it's going to the national organization at times, and then the monies don't come back. That's what we're trying to determine one way or the other. We've heard that nationally less than 1% of all monies raised by the National Humane Society actually go back into local shelters. We're trying to determine that as it relates to this particular situation with the tornadoes last year. It's a very important exercise that we're engaged in because Anyone that gives money to a 501c3, anyone that gives money to serve purposes, they want to make sure that it goes to serve those purposes. Oklahomans gave money to help local shelters. Did those monies actually go to local shelters? Or were they used by the national organization to advance media and PR in association with PETA and others to advance the political agenda as opposed to helping those local shelters? That's something we're trying to ascertain. It's the scope of authority that we have, and they've not been terribly responsive. I mean, they've sent some communications back, correspondence. There's been meetings here in this office between my representatives and the National Humane Society. We have subpoena power, Trent, and we intend to find out whether the National Humane Society came in to raise money at the expense of Oklahomans and determine whether it, in fact, went to local shelters. We're going to find out, and if they didn't allocate the monies that way, if they made representations that way, we'll take steps of accountability.
Attorney General of the State of Oklahoma, Scott Pruitt, my guest. We'll take a break. We'll come back with more about the erosion of personal property rights in the name of the Lesser Prairie Chicken et al. After this.
All right, folks, let's check in on the opportunity to buy or sell cattle this week at Superior. No video sale this week, but posted on the website Friday. Here's what was posted. From Missouri, Bill Brody representing West Plains, Missouri cattle, 90 head of weaned steer calves weighing 550 pounds. Thayer, Missouri. Steve Anderson, the rep on these 100 weaned heifer calves. They weigh 490 pounds. Gary Owen, Montana. These are Montana Angus cattle. Here we pay attention. 219 heifer calves weighing 565 pounds. They were posted. Forget that. They sold. $202 a hundredweight. They're sold. 219 heifer calves. The steer calves, the mates to those, 206 steer calves weighing 600 pounds, have not sold, though. So get the details about cattle for sale on the website at SuperiorLivestock.com. Click on the country page and then link to the calves.
Welcome back to Rural Routes. I'm Trent Luce, Scott Pruitt, Attorney General for the State of Oklahoma, our guest today. And I've not been officially diagnosed with ADD. It's just that we got a lot of things that are happening and coming to us from every single direction, Scott, and we're just trying to cover all of them. We could have a three-hour show today, I believe.
There's definitely enough to say grace over.
I want to share this story with you, and I've not been able to get him to agree to come on this program yet, but in December, speaking of Wayne Pacelli, I had the great fortune of debating him for what it was called a debate, which he didn't want to engage in. But we each addressed the state legislators in Washington, D.C. for about 1 hour and 10 minutes. After we concluded, there was an individual representing agencies that addressed the same state legislators. One of those individuals was with the Bureau of Land Management, a retired military gentleman for 24 years, and then just in his retirement thought that he would just go work with BLM because he loves hunting, he loves nature, and he's quitting. He's quitting effective next month because he said, Trent, this is not at all what I signed up for. He said, for example, the Lesser Prairie Chicken, it doesn't matter what you say, it doesn't matter what science you find. This agency has decided, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, has decided that they are going to list the Lesser Prairie Chicken as a threatened species. That is somewhat troubling, not somewhat, that is extremely troubling that a guy who was on the inside sees what's happening and leaving the BLM because of that very example. But that's what we're up against here, is that somebody, Scott, says that we're going to make sure that we protect this Lesser Prairie Chicken for whatever the ultimate goal is, and they're going to make it happen.
So the question becomes why? And I think that there's a great concern that it's about one thing, and that's restricting land use in that five-state habitat, including Oklahoma. And I believe, Trent, that there is a direct correlation between, you know, this sue and settle agreement that the Fish and Wildlife Service entered into in 2011, where all 250 species will be placed in either a warranted or not warranted category within a very expedited timeline. And the objective was about really one thing, and that was to impose land land use restrictions on farming, agricultural, and energy development across the various states that those species, the habitat is located. And so it's another way for the agenda of Wild Earth Guardians and Sierra Club and others to be advanced. And it's all under this carbon umbrella of truly trying to dial back, you know, our ability as Americans to access our natural resources and to grow our economy and grow our businesses and grow our economy in general. It's just very frustrating. And the gentleman that you're referring to leaving that, I can understand why, because it's not just, reflective of the EPA. It's EPA, Fish and Wildlife Service, Department of Interior, Bureau of Land Management. There are multiple agencies that are engaged in that exercise.
Should we use the 10th Amendment more to combat this?
You know, I think that we are. I mean, I think, you know, it's a good question, Trent, because a lot of times these cases that we're bringing have 10th Amendment connotations, but they're really not at their core 10th Amendment cases. I mean, this Fish and Wildlife Service case that we have in the federal court in Tulsa is truly it's statutory. It's Congress has said one thing, and an agency has done exactly the opposite. And so it's really a breach. You know, it's a breach of authority. It's a breach of the checks and balances that we know that has some 10th Amendment connotations. But we try to camp on, because we know the courts are responsive to those kinds of cases. You know, mm-hmm. An agency has legally deference, you know, so long as they're acting within the power given them by Congress. That's what the courts have said historically. But here, we're not even getting to deference. You know, we're getting, you know, in the first blush at a question of, do you have the power to do that, what you're doing? Did Congress say that you could do what you're doing? And in many instances with BLM, in many instances with Fish and Wildlife Service and EPA and IRS and HHS and the Health Care, the Affordable Care Act, or as you put it, the Unaffordable Care Act, we see that they are acting completely inconsistent, absolutely opposite of what the statute says in its plain meaning. So it puts the states in a position of having to do about something about that. I've been asked many times as I've been in D.C. by the national media, why are you wasting all the resources of the states engaged in this litigation? And my response has been, I would be recalcitrant. I would be negligent if I didn't respond. I mean, think about what Oklahoma did here. Oklahoma, along with all these other stakeholders, spent $26 million to avoid the lesser prairie chicken being put in the threatened category. And the Fish and Wildlife Service agreed to that in March of 2013 and completely disregarded it in March of this year. They're acting in an uncontrollable manner. So where does that put us? It puts us in a litigation mode of having to say, we're going to do something about it. I'm so thankful, Trent, and I mean this sincerely. You know, as an attorney general, I don't have to go get permission from the governor. I don't have to get the vote of the legislature. I can sit in my office. I can evaluate these cases. I can evaluate the actions by these agencies, and we can go out and charge the hill. And we're not just charging the hill, we're winning. We beat the EPA on the cross-state air pollution rule. We beat the EPA under the Clean Air Act in regional haze. So we're not just making noise, Trent. We're winning. And I'm hopeful in this case that we see the same outcome, victory.
You're actually on the border of answering my question before I even ask them, because I was my theme this year has been grow a pear. And if you come to Stillwater tonight, you'll understand why I started that theme. But it's time that the country grows a pair and people stand up for what they think is right, no matter what political correct thing is supposedly supposed to happen. And I was going to ask you, who does the Attorney General need to get permission from before they take a ballsy act like this, filing a lawsuit against Fish and Wildlife? You don't need to consult with anybody, but you surely do.
I'm sorry?
You don't need to consult with anybody, but surely the governor and other individuals, key leaders in the state, would be in on the consultation before action is taken?
We take it very seriously, to your point. I mean, we challenged the Dodd-Frank legislation that was passed also in 2010, just a few months after the health care law was passed. And we spent a year and a half, mm-hmm. Preparing that case. Didn't file it until August, I think, of 12, after having started talking about it in March of 11. You know, so we take the job very seriously. It's not that we just act whimsically or in a expedited way. But, you know, at the same time, you know, Trent, we don't have to go get permission. And so we act responsibly, but we act with courage. You know, Teddy Roosevelt one time said, you know, in any given situation, the best thing you can do is the right thing. The next best thing you can do is the wrong thing. The worst thing you can do is nothing. And I'm so thankful that, you know, in the position that I'm in, both myself and other attorneys general across the country, we can truly look at the actions being taken by these agencies, and we don't have to go get approval to take them on. I mean, it's we just have to do our job and do homework and make sure that we've got a valid case and we've got standing to bring the case, and that's what these cases represent at the end of the day, accountability. Let me tell you, the Justice Department, Fish and Wildlife Service in this particular case, they should be concerned about it. They engaged in a process that I think clearly was not within the bounds of the Administrative Procedures Act. They engaged in rulemaking outside of the rulemaking process, and they totally obliterated the statute and eliminated a third category that Congress said that they must consider. I mean, think about it. They had 250-plus species that they were studying, and all of a sudden in 2011 they said, well, we're not going to do that anymore. We're not going to study those. We're going to go out and put them in the, either the warranted or not warranted bucket, and we're going to do so in a timeline that we know we can't meet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what does that mean? That means that they're not doing their job consistent with the way Congress told them they have to do their job. And somebody's going to hold them accountable, and thank goodness, as an attorney general, we can take that step to do so.
Yeah, we have to have a set of ears before you can hear what Congress has to say to you. While you're quoting infamous individuals that shaped our country, I got a quote for you that I wonder if you know who came up with it. And I realize I'm at risk of making my guest look bad, but here, I'm going to take a chance. Are you game?
I'm game.
The budget is like a mythical beanbag. Congress continues to allocate mythical beans into the bag, believing that one day they can pull real beans out.
Well, I don't know who said it. It sounds like my good friend Senator Coburn. But
oh, now you're sucking up to Senator Coburn. It was another.
No, I mean it does sound like something Senator Coburn would say.
He actually probably did say that, but I'll tell you, he stole it from somebody who also was in Oklahoma. He wasn't born in the state of Oklahoma, but he was born in Oklahoma Territory.
And who might that be?
Will Rogers, 1929. So my point is, do we really think we're going to change this? It's been around a while.
Oh, absolutely. I think we have to be optimistic that we will. I mean, I will tell you this, Trent, in the next 2 years, I don't have much optimism that there's anything that's going to change. You know, I've often wondered, you know, what Congress seems to be in the business at times of just allocating, kind of giving away its authority to these agencies. I mean, when you look at the Dodd-Frank law,
mm-hmm.
they created a whole new agency, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, gave it authority and rulemaking a power that is not even revealed by the courts, gave it money out of the Treasury Department so Congress doesn't have oversight. And you got to step back and say, why did you do that, Congress? And I think a lot of times, Trent, it's because our leaders, if you want to call them that at times, in Congress are more than willing to pass the buck so they can come back to Nebraska and Oklahoma and Iowa and Texas and various states across the country. And when someone complains to them and says, well, look, you're killing us. The community banks are going, you know, dry because of what you've done to them. And they say, well, we didn't do that. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau did that. And so they pass the buck and they pass authority. I mean, we've got to get people in Washington, D.C., Trent, in the legislature that are serious about legislating and not passing that responsibility to agencies, because agencies are unaccountable to you and me. You know, we all know that. And they get away with these things that we're talking about because they are not accountable directly to people. But there is one process to hold them accountable, and that's through the courts. Okay. And the courts get a lot of criticism, and justifiably so at times. But thank goodness that we have judges and we have an independent judiciary that is not accountable to this president, you know, that are going to postdate his time in the White House, meaning that they have some independence in order to say, you know what, Mr. President, you're wrong. You know what, Kathy Sebelius, you're wrong. You know what, Gina McCarthy at the EPA, you're wrong. And we hope that they said the same thing about the Fish and Wildlife Service.
We need to take a break. Our last one, more Rural Route with Scott Pruitt, Attorney General of Oklahoma, after this.
Let that be the reminder for the bully puppet. That's where Theodore Roosevelt went to be a rancher. Being a rancher in the Badlands of North Dakota taught him to be a better person and the president of the United States. It happened in Medora, my favorite destination in the nation. Check out the happenings in Medora next year on the web, www.medorand.com.
Welcome back to Rural Routes. I'm Trent Luce. We have charged with flying colors into the final segment. The Attorney General for the state of Oklahoma, Scott Pruitt, is my guest. We've talked about a plethora of things. While we're talking about a plethora of things, I actually broke one of my own rules. I asked you about this off the air, but I want you to explain something to us, and I know it's not necessarily something you're working on, but give us the legalities of Common Core, something that is coming down from the, and by the way, this came to my mind because I saw last week where the Common Core teaching method was asking students which two of the Bill of Rights are no longer necessary. Holy cow, are you serious?
Right. Well,
so what exactly is Common Core, and how do you see that in the state of Oklahoma? And by the way, let me just also brag, although I can claim no credit, the state of Nebraska does not follow Common Core.
Well, Common Core, two words, and many legislatures across the country, including Oklahoma, did in fact, unlike Nebraska, adopt the term Common Core. Common meaning that it's common amongst the 50 states, and core meaning it's about standards. And, you know, it's a long train, I believe, Trent, where we have those outside of the state, Washington with the Department of Education, trying to come in and dictate or to determine what standards should be on a local basis. And that's just simply not the historical role of the federal government. And states should be, in my estimation, Trent, when I was in the legislature here in Oklahoma, I served in the Senate for 8 years and then left and back in the private sector for a number of years and then ran for Attorney General. But when I was in the legislature, you know, we were very attentive to adopting curriculum that was college ready, that helped folks pursue a, you know, K through 12 curriculum that gave them options as they graduated high school. Not everyone will go to college. We all understand that, but they ought to be prepared to go to college, and states ought to take that seriously as far as standards that they're adopting. But here you have something different. Here you have something outside of the borders of the respective states, a group of individuals and associations that join together to define what that core curriculum should be and then make it common, you know, across the entire country. And to me, that is inconsistent with the role that states should be jealously guarding, you know, and that's to determine standards on a state-by-state basis, making decisions that's reflective of that state on what's best for the children of that state, and not to be, you know, in an environment where someone else outside the state is dictating to you what you can and cannot do. So, I mean, that's a philosophical statement. I mean, we're not involved in that. Trent, as you and I talked about, mm-hmm. The state of Oklahoma actually passed a statute, quote-unquote, adopting Common Core. So it's not a legal issue. It's a policy issue and a legislative issue. But it is something important. I mean, education, in my estimation, should prepare you for life. I mean, there was a great debate many, many years ago, back in the 1930s, between a gentleman by the name of Dewey, and I think the other person's name was Hutchinson, as I recall, as I remember my history, and they debated, what is the purpose of education? And one of those gentlemen took the view that it's to prepare you for a job. The other person took the view that it's to prepare you for life. And, you know, the first view is what they use in China. You know, the first view is, you know, we're going to give you tests early in your academic career, determine what your aptitude is, and then put you on a track, you know, of what we want you to do and pursue in your life. If they'd have done that with me, Trent, I don't know about you, but I wasn't big in math in fifth grade. I didn't get the option of taking Algebra 2. I just had to take it. I had to struggle with it. You know, and I think a lot of times the academic educational philosophy of our country is we just want to use it to prepare people for jobs, you know, and I don't think a fifth grader or a sixth grader or an eighth grader or even a 12th grader should be making that decision. I think they ought to, you know, learn, and then as they experience life, make decisions on how they want, you know, to use the talents that God's given them. And I think that's the debate, what we see with Common Core.
Yeah, well, we have talked about here today the situation involving the U.S. Fish and Wildlife putting the lesser prairie chicken on the threatened list with 250 other species, removing control from Oklahomans and any other state that's listening or where people live and work the land. We've talked about HSUS coming into a local event, possibly as you're investigating, pulling money out, going back to a federal pool. We've talked about California putting in place a law that says all states must comply with what we want. And now we're talking about teaching standards, which are coming from a federal government telling our kids how you have to teach in Oklahoma, Nebraska, Minnesota. There's a common theme to every one of these stories, Scott. You don't have to be too smart to figure out, hey, there's a trend developing here.
It's a command and control type of trend, right? I mean, it's, you know, when you think about what the founders really what spurred them, and I think there are many things, but one of the things that really spurred them to revolt, declare independence and fight the war was their ability to make a life was being affected by someone they could not see and they could not touch. There was someone across the ocean who was issuing rules and laws, and the folks that were here, the governors that were put in place by the crown, you know, were simply there to carry out the wishes of the monarch. And so George Washington and our founders and others, you know, they didn't want to be reliant upon that. They didn't want to be dependent on someone they could not see and they could not touch to make a life. They wanted to, you know, pursue happiness and what that meant to them and grow their their businesses at that time for the benefit of their families and to pass, you know, wealth to the fallen generations. And so they rebelled against that. And today, Trent, you know, in my estimation, as you look at Washington, D.C., we have people that we cannot see, we cannot touch, we cannot influence that truly are impacting our ability to make a life. I mean, they're keeping us from doing the things that are fundamental to what is, you know, I think inherent in the Constitution, property rights and the pursuit of happiness and ability to not be constricted arbitrarily, you know, by an agency or others. And it's happening routinely. And it's sad. But I will tell you this. We can't just accept it. We have to take steps to respond. That's what we're doing with these cases. I mean, Norman Schwarzkopf, I spent some time with him a few years ago, and he provided a two-sentence definition of leadership that I thought was just powerful. He said, you know what, a leader is someone that when they're in command, they take charge. They make decisions. They lead. And secondly, they do what's right. And we need more leaders across the country that have been put in leadership positions, like governors and AGs and congressmen and senators and presidents, to lead. But then to do the second part, do what's right, and not just simply what's expedient for them to get reelected, et cetera. And these agencies are way too powerful. The accountability is not there. We've got to require our legislators, our congressional members, to take back that authority. And until they choose to do so, the courts are the only place we can go to help tell them they have to do that, to say that law or that action that they took, that rule that they passed, was unconstitutional because they didn't do so consistent with the language that Congress did pass. So these are big cases, Trent.
Don't we have a similar situation, just in a different color, with fracking and recovery of oil from the soil?
Absolutely. BLM, you mentioned BLM earlier. Governor Jindal in Louisiana, myself, I chaired the Republican AGs Association for 2 years. Governor Jindal was the leader of the Republican Governors Association. We sent a joint letter to BLM. It's been almost 2 years ago. They were in the process of adopting a rule to restrict hydraulic fracturing. You know, states like Oklahoma, we've been regulating the hydraulic fracturing process since 1948. You know, people in Pennsylvania and Ohio, New York think that this is a new process. It's been around for decades. We dedicate millions of dollars to the regulatory aspect, and we do so with great care and precision. And to somehow think that the federal government's going to be able to come in and do that better, or that they're going to displace the state of Oklahoma, is all about one thing. It's all about them trying to make the permitting process so costly, so time-consuming, that production of natural gas and production of oil slows down. It's crazy what we're doing in the energy context. I mean, we have the ability to export liquefied natural gas today. We can export oil today, Trent, as you know. Mm-hmm. There's been a ban on that, boycott on that since the 1970s. If we really want to create jobs in this country, let's get serious about energy development. Let's get serious about, you know, making sure that we take advantage of all of our natural resources and do so in a safe way, but do so in a way that we can see robust growth, more than 2%. I mean, we have the infrastructure, we have the capital, we have the expertise and the know-how. There's one thing standing in the way, and that's government. And government should not be standing in the way. the manufacturing renaissance that could occur if we just get serious about energy development, the low cost of electricity that would occur, you know, with natural gas and oil and coal production. You know, they have an anti-fossil fuel, you know, mentality, and it's manifested in its attack on hydraulic fracturing, as you've indicated, Trent. And but it's another example of an attack on land use.
Same exact story, just a different shade and different avenue of approach. So, Scott Pruitt, final thing, as I think I've got you nailed down on where you stand on every single thing, except a commitment to meet me on the campus at Oklahoma State tonight, and we can discuss these things further in private.
Well, I'd love to see you, Trent, but and I mean that sincerely. Maybe we can do it another time, but I'm heading out of state and won't be able to attend. But, you know, I've enjoyed our discussion.
Yep.
And you didn't ask me who's going to win the World Series. You didn't get me, nailed down on that. I'm an old baseball guy. We own the
You want a tough question? I'll give you one tough one before we leave.
Okay.
Who's the next governor of my state going to be?
In Nebraska?
Yes. Our attorney general's running, so I'm wanting to see how tight the brotherhood is here.
You know, John and I have worked on many things together. I actually met with Pete. What's Pete's last
name? Ricketts.
Running for governor. Actually, Pete is an old baseball guy. That's probably what prompted your question. Was involved with the Cubs, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. You tell me politically. I think John has been a great attorney general. I think his desire to run for governor is admirable, because we need great leaders in the governor's offices across the country as well. Pete seems like a great business guy. Obviously, I'm not out there endorsing or contributing money, but it sounds like you got a couple of good choices.
Yep, but you didn't make any headway, because that's where everybody stands right now, with the same summation that you came up with, but we have to have one. So
That's why you have elections.
Yeah, it is why we have an election, and it'll happen soon enough. My thanks, sincere thank you, not only for joining me on the air, but Scott Pruitt, for standing up for what is right and bringing this back to local control. That's the bottom line, and let the people who own the resources and the property continue to drive the ship. I'll see you soon.
Thank you, Trent.
We have successfully journeyed down the road connecting at rural and urban America. Once again, my thanks to Scott Pruitt from the state of Oklahoma, the Attorney General. I'm Trent Luce. I said that. All roads do lead to a rural route.
So it's been a week now since the 29th annual Altech Symposium, and as I think about the activities that took place last week in Lexington, Kentucky, all of the topics and discussion are really about improving the world's food supply, particularly from a quality standpoint, providing better choices. Now, I'm not going to say that we need to make choices for the consumer, but I'm going to say that we need to do everything that we can to produce better quality food and feeding genomics. That is the one key phrase, turning on the right genes with the right nutrition to minimize disease and improve quality of life. That's the summary of the Altech Symposium, and we do it through better quality feed products to the animals, ultimately improving human lives. Details about feeding genomics and turning on the right genes can be found on the web, www.altech.com.